Thanks for the invitation to give a talk here. I'm going to talk about some work I've done with Robert Dycraft and a number of other collaborators. Let's see, is this focused? I guess the light is probably. Thank you. So I'll first describe the origin of the ideas leading to the statements. Let's see, which start with this?
Over there. There's a point in there.
Thank you. So, I'm going to talk about where the idea started from, and in particular, what's the string origin of these ideas, string theory origin. Then I will, after the explanation of some of the basic features of the origin of the ideas, I'll directly go to the statement of the results and the proof of it. And then I'll talk about the applications. Applications being the derivation of some aspects of Olive-Montanan duality, and its deformation to n equals to 1 star, derivation of Seiberg-Witten geometry and its extensions to matter and so forth. And then I will talk about some extensions of these ideas. Mainly this part, namely the relation of this in higher dimensions. So going beyond 4 dimension to 4 plus d dimensions, supersymmetric gauge theories, and its relation to d dimensional gauge systems. The case d equal to 0 being the first example. That is the first part of the talk. And also in this part, I'm going to also talk about the relation of this to C equals to 1 strings and some aspects of that. Also to deconstruction and 2,0 strings in 6 dimension. Then I'm going to talk about, well, I'm not going to talk about this. I believe Hiroshi gave a talk already on this here, if I'm not mistaken. So the higher genus extension of these ideas has already been discussed here, so I will not mention it. And then I may just, one transparency here, so talk about general these to other groups and general representations. The origin of the idea is that the topological strings is a bosonic string. Namely, in the bosonic string theory, we have a BRSD operator, we have the anti-ghost, we have the ghost current, and we have the energy momentum tensor. And a system having these with the appropriate OPEs is a bosonic string. So n equal to 2 superconformal field theory provides such an example for any n equal to 2 superconformal system. So the statement is that n equal to superconformal theory is a bosonic string. This was an observation of Witten already, I don't know, 14 years ago. So we can use n equal to 2 systems to talk as if we have found backgrounds for bosonic string and compute amplitudes. And so then the question is, how do we get n equal to 2 superconformal theories? And the simplest way to do that is when you have a target space being a Calabi-Yau default. So if you take a Calabi-Yau default, then you will immediately get this with some appropriate central charges. But the only thing is that you have to actually not only take this sigma model, but twisted version of it, which means you take the energy momentum tensor and take a combination of this with the derivative of the current. And this has the feature that the t hat has 0 OPE in front, so central charge is 0. And this is called the topological twisting. So this shifts the spin of G plus from 3 halves down to 1 half to 1, and this shifts it up to 3 to 2. So it is the same as you would expect here. Though there's one difference between this side and that side. This side, if you look at the violation of the U1 charge, in genus G, you get a violation of the dimension of the Calabi-Yau times G minus 1. Whereas in the bosonic string, the ghost violation is a set amount, 3 times G minus 1. And this is very useful because precisely that's what gets absorbed by the folding of the Bs with the electronic differentials in trying to give you a measure on the marginal light to integrate. Here, if you try to do that, you would fail except when D is 3. So Calabi-Yau threefold is picked out precisely as a natural bosonic string, and dimension 3 is the same as the dimension of SL2, which is the same thing as 3 going into dimensional moduli. So it's very natural, therefore, that Calabi-Yau threefold should be studied, forgetting altogether about string, superstring theory, just because of bosonic string in its own right. So one thing I forgot to say, that this might, the only thing which is not obvious is whether or not this system and that system are actually realized in a more traditional way in terms of bosons of some object moving in space-time as in bosonic string. And there are examples where actually these are related. For example, C equals to 1, bosonic string, non-critical bosonic string, is equivalent to some particular Calabi-Yau threefold geometry, the conifold, as I will mention later. Now, so topological strings on a Calabi-Yau, what are they useful for in superstring? Well, it turns out that what they're useful for is that the F terms, they compute F terms for type 2 superstrings. So the fact that the Calabi-Yau threefolds appear in superstrings suggests that it's not surprising to expect such a relation between something that string theory on a Calabi-Yau does, the topological string, and a superstring, which is also has a Calabi-Yau threefold as a natural thing in it. So if you compute, consider a compactification of superstrings now on a Calabi-Yau threefold, you get n equal to supersymmetry in four dimensions, and there are some F terms in the effective type 2 superstring on this Calabi-Yau, and this relates to the topological string amplitude. For example, if you take type 2 strings on Calabi-Yau threefold, the superstring data is given by integration over a superspace, n equal to chiral superspace. There are 8 thetas, but this is a chiral piece of it. And you have some vector multiplet, let's say, and then you take, you have this prepotential of the n equal to 2 prepotential. And this prepotential of the n equal to 2 is exactly the genus 0 partition function of the Calabi-Yau, where the SI refers to the sizes, the moduli of the Calabi-Yau, which corresponds in this superstring context to the superfield, which corresponds to the vector multiplet. So this relation between them is actually very simple in the Berkowitz formalism, where you basically start with a topologically twisted Calabi-Yau as a piece of a superstring, and in addition you have x thetas and some other ghosts, actually just one ghost, so it's not that complicated. You just have x's, thetas, p's, and the left and the right moving versions of them together with the only one ghost. So in this Berkowitz formalism, the superstring is very easy to deal with. And in the topological computation, the only relevant mode turns out to be the theta modes and the x mode, and for these F terms. And these are those zero modes computations left over in this computation. And actually, you can formulate a topological string which includes these fields in it and just computes this directly as a amplitude. And that's something we're working on currently with Berkowitz and Oguri. So you can actually make this map even more direct. There's also this open string version. So open topological strings on a Calabi-Yau threefold in this context means basically putting D brains on the Calabi-Yau. And in the type 2 superstring, it's you start with the Calabi-Yau threefold times R4 and you put some D brains wrapped around some cycles. And the natural thing to do is to fill the space-time, the D brain, space-time filling D brains put there so there's no extra data in the R4. So then you can have here in this left-hand side the open bosonic string or open topological string amplitudes. And the right-hand side, you can say the corresponding F terms in the n equals to 1. Now you have broken the supersymmetry down to n equals to 1 because of the d-brains. So the statement would be that you would think that computation of open topological amplitudes are computing F terms in n equals to 1. And this was shown to be true, again, a while back by Bershadsky et al., that if you compute on the topological string amplitudes, genus, let's say, for example, 0 with H holes, as a function of these various SIs, then this corresponds to computing on the superstring side the superpotential for the glue ball field, trace W squared to the H minus 1 times this with this factor. So somehow this was already suggesting there's something special about the glue ball superpotential because that's what topological string computes, which is what attracted our attention to this at all in the first place, that this we should be studying, because superstring was doing that, computing that. And the fact, well, there are various ways to see this dictionary, but one way to see it is that each time you have a cut on the word sheet, you have an end point and a beginning point, and each end point and a beginning point creates a twist because you're twisting, the energy momentum tensor has this twisting. So each time you have a curvature on the word sheet, you're actually twisting, and putting that twist means putting a fermion ground state. So you put two per cut. So each cut gives you a W, so they are along the cut, you get trace of W squared, that's where you're getting gluino. So it's very natural from the worksheet picture that we're getting trace W squared on this potential. Now, in the context of topological string, there was a large duality that Rajesh and I noticed a while back, which is topological open string, which means the topological string with some D-brains around, is equivalent to topological closed strings without D-brains. Where if you take the genus G and H holes of this open topological strings and weigh it with the S to the H, with the tooth parameter, then this corresponds to Calabia, where the tooth parameter becomes a moduli of the Calabia. This is very much in the spirit of ADS-CFD. You have D-brains and open string, and here the D-brain has disappeared. The moduli, the sizes of the geometry depends on the tooth parameter. Well, given that this is true, and given that these are computing F-terms in n equals to 1 and n equals to 2 respectively, the question is, how does this suggest about superstring? And this is where we conjecture the existence of a superstring duality based on this duality. You embed this and you get a statement that type 2 on Calabia threefold is related to type 2 on a deformed Calabia threefold. On the left side, you also have n D-brains wrapped. On the right-hand side, the D-brains have gone and replaced by Ramon-Ramon fluxes. So the left-hand side, if you now go back to see what this was computing here, for example, at genus 0, what you were computing were these amplitudes correspond to computing glue ball superpotentials on the left. And if you then translate it on the right, you find that this gets related to the superpotential, which is now has this auxiliary field turned on, corresponding to turning on n units of Ramon-Ramon flux. So that gives you n times df0ds. So this suggests that n df0ds, the period of a Calabia, which is given by df0ds, is related to a corresponding open string computation, and it's computing the superpotential. And the dictionary here is that the gluino field is being replaced by a moduli there. The moduli of Calabia is becoming that VEV, the VEV of that field. Okay, so this was the origin of the ideas. If this was not clear, you can forget about it. We start from scratch again. N equals to 1, so as if we didn't know anything about string theory or D-brains and topological strings and all that, just start what the statement is. You take n equals to 1 supersymmetric theories in 4 dimensions, and the prototype of it is n equals to 1 UN gauge theory in 4 dimensions with adjoint field, phi. So we put one matter field adjoint, w, phi, and we introduce a superpotential W of phi, which is some polynomial. The classical vacua are given by the critical points of W, which I write it in this form in terms of the VEV of the eigenvalues of phi being any of the n values of AI. So if you distribute the eigenvalues to some bunches A1, some A2s, and so on, then UN breaks to UN1 times UN2, etc., up to UNN in this particular vacuum, where the summation of NI is N, the total rank of the group that we started with. In the low energy limit, we have UNI with an adjoint field, which has now broken down, UNI with adjoint fields which are now massive near each of these critical points. There's a phi squared potential, so they become massive. So you just basically get a pure n equals to 1 in the infrared limit. And we know the pure infrared wants to confine, so you just get n confining SUNs. And their U1s are still there, so you have n photons, n U1s, plus the confining theory like this. And so what kind of question we might be interested in? Well, we're only going to be asking questions which are holomorphic in the n equals to 1 context, which means, well, the first, a quantitative question, how many vacua do we have? And then if we know how many vacua we have, the next question is, what is the value of the superpotential at each vacuum? What that means is, of course, has various meanings. Namely, it corresponds to facts like the tension of the domain wall. So if you have one vacuum going to another vacuum, the change in W is giving you a BPS tension of domain walls. It also has other meaning, namely the expectation value of the fields. If you deform the theory by some chiral field and see how the W changes, the expectation value of that operator is just a derivative of W at that vacuum. So you can use this to compute everything you want as far as the expectation value of the chiral fields in various vacuum. So that has a lot of information already in it. The next question we might want to ask is these U1s. So there are n U1s, so there could be coupling constants, which are again holomorphic moduli. And one might want to know what are these coupling constants in the infrared, given the data we start with. Okay, let me make the statement by considering an associated matrix model. The matrix model is M by N Hermitian, and M is not to be confused with N. N was the rank of the UN gauge group, and M is not the rank of the UN gauge group, it's some other rank, independent of it. You take the matrix model with superpotential. You can think of it Hermitian, but I'm actually not going to be using that too much, other than the fact that I'm going to be concentrating on the perturbative diagrams here, so you might as well think of it as if it's Hermitian, even though the coupling here are not real, so it's not going to be relevant for me whether the non-perturbative definition of this might be. I'm just going to be interested in perturbative aspects of this matrix model. So we take this matrix model, and actually what's called the gauge matrix model, which means that we divide by the volume of the UM, and there is this Etouffee expansion. So we put a 1 over G string here so that we have this usual expansion, L Etouffee, where Fg is a function of the Etouffee parameter Gs times the rank of the phi, and the various other coefficients in the potential, which are these AIs. In fact, there are various Etouffee parameters here, because depending on which critical point you're expanding the matrix model about, you have different number of ways you can distribute the eigenvalues of phi between AIs. So you have the two parameters mi times gs, and so these potentials, the free energy and so forth, will depend on these combination of the two parameter and the values of this matrix model, values of this potential of this matrix model. Okay, so this is F0, is the genus 0, or the planar diagrams of this matrix model. Okay, the statement is that the superpotential, the effective superpotential as a function of the S in the gauge theory, is the same as the derivative of the free energy of the matrix model with respect to the Etouffee parameter times Ni, where this Si is the Etouffee parameter of the matrix model, minus the bare coupling here. This is the bare term in the action, tau times trace W squared. Secondly, the tau ij, the coupling constant of the U1s, so this is the effective glue wall potential. The coupling constants of the U1s is given by the second derivative of F0 of the matrix model, again, with respect to SS. And what we are supposed to do with this W is the following. You're supposed to treat SI as a fundamental field, effective good variables in the infrared, take the derivative of W with respect to SI, set it to zero, find the critical values, plug it back to W, and once you do that, you'll find the value of W at the various critical points, so you can evaluate W at these vacua, so that's the value of superpotential, and you plug in the value of the critical value for the glue ball field, and you compute the tau ij. And this leads to exact non-perturbative results for the F terms. So what's the proof? Well, the idea is the following. You take the measure factor of matrix model, that's the 1 over the volume of the UM in front. Once you do the analysis I told you in the previous transparency, you get from the measure factor already the Veneziano-Yankelevich part of the glue ball superpotential. So that part is already the measure factor of the matrix model. And then, if you take the perturbative planar diagram of gauge theory, so first of all, you can show that the perturbative diagrams contribute to superpotential, and moreover, you can actually compute them. So you show that only the planar diagrams contribute, first of all. Secondly, the planar diagrams, if you try to sit down and do the Feynman diagrams computation, dramatically simplify, and basically boil down to the combinatorics of that graph, which is already captured by the matrix model answer. So this is going to be the link. Basically, the statement is that the 4D computation is easy, the Feynman diagram, and therefore, no wonder we can compute in terms of matrix model. So what about the measure factor? Well, the measure of a matrix model has a 1 over volume of UM. In fact, this part has nothing to do really with matrix model. You can take the UM gauge theory in zero dimension, no matrices. So that's the answer, that the partition function 1 over the volume of the UM. So that is pure N equals to 1 Yang-Mills with no matter, for example. If you write that already, that's given by e to the 1 half m squared log m plus subleading terms. Subleading terms correspond in the large N expansion to the non-planar diagrams. Well, there's no diagram here, but what you would call suppressed by order 1 over N corrections. So the leading term actually is just 1 over g string squared times s squared log s, where s is mgs, Hitzkopf parameter. So the free energy is 1 half s squared log s. And ndf 0 ds is ns log s, and that's Veneziani-Ankliovich. Then that was the dictionary we had for w. So w already gives you the Veneziani-Ankliovich just from this measure. Incidentally, this is not a well-known fact, but it's true that this is itself, without the derivative, just this whole expansion, is the partition function of c equals to 1 at self 2 radius. So this, if you do the expansion, all the subleading terms, you're actually writing the c equals to 1 partition function at self 2 radius, which will be related to what I will tell later. Now, this computation, this idea of the superpotential of Veneziani-Ankliovich was really very simple. Their idea was, basically, the Adler-Bergier-Jacquive anomaly can be integrated to give you this. Namely, if you take, define the global field and do the chiral rotation of this Gluino fields, and remember that d2 theta picks up the measure, you see that the action is invariant, d2 theta s. However, Adler-Bergier-Jacquive tell us that's not the symmetry of the quantum theory. The variation of the action is given by f wedge f times the n. And they note that this f wedge f times n is itself given by n s times d2 theta. So they basically want to say the variation of this with respect to phase rotation to give you an s term times n, integrating that gives you this up to a linear term in s. That's basically how they solve the exact answer based on the fact that this is exact. And so the next thing is to compute the perturbative terms for the global potential. So we are, the idea is you have a mass of fields, you integrate it out, and compute the superpotential, but we are not doing a complicated computation in a sense because it's holomorphic. Holomorphic computations are supposed to be easy, so we basically see why the computation is easy. And the computation actually, the idea is very simple again. So you have such a theory with an adjoint action on the vector on these adjoint fields. So this is the vector multiplet and this is the matter field with some superpotential. We're trying to compute the global superpotential, which is a function of S. This is a chiral computation, so it does not really depend on the details of what you pick for the W bar piece. The anti-chiral fields will not appear in the holomorphic terms. The way to see that is that you can always promote these parameters to fields, and anti-chiral fields cannot appear in the chiral superspace. So we know whatever we set for W bar will not affect this computation. So we set an easy one, which is M bar phi bar squared. So when you set m bar phi bar squared, the phi bar dependence is a bit trivial. You just get phi by phi, and the phi bar squared is quadratic in phi bar. You integrate phi bar out, and you get an action purely in terms of the chiral field phi itself. So we do that, and we choose a background. So we treat the V as a background, and we choose this Gluino background. If you're interested in computation of the global superpotential, we might as well choose a simple background to compute. So we choose a covariantly constant background for W, which basically means abelian and constant W. And the action boils down to a very simple action, which is this. This is a chiral action. So you have a phi box phi with a Gluino field W alpha del alpha. This del alpha is dd theta alpha, derivative in the super directions. And W alpha is the Gluino field. And there's a superpotential plus W phi. This integration is only in the chiral part of the superspace, as it should be because phi is a chiral superfield. So you have this effective theory, and this effective theory, you could try to compute various diagrams. So at this level, I have not made any assumptions about whether the theory is UN or adjoint or whatever. You can actually do this for any group, any representation, as long as you can add the mass, basically, which is what I assume to get rid of the phi bar piece. Now, we are interested in computation of the global superpotential. So if you replace in the Feynman diagram with a box with a p squared and del alpha with pi alpha, with del alpha dd theta alpha, so you can introduce fermionic momenta, pi alpha, corresponds to the dd theta alpha. Then the propagator you can read off from here, m bar divided by p squared plus mm bar w alpha pi alpha. You see, you might be surprised at first sight that there's an m bar dependence here, and it should not appear there. However, this m bar dependence is very much like Fujikawa's beta dependence. It disappears, as it should, in the final computation. So this is just a regulator, if you wish. And the actual answer is the m-bars does not appear in the final answer as it shouldn't. So again, we are inspired from string theory to use the Schwinger parameter representation, not the Feynman diagram representation the way we usually do, but write it as if we're doing string theory. So we introduce the worksheet times or Schwinger times, Schwinger parameters S's, and so we write propagators in this form, as we would do in string theory. For an L-loop diagrams, we have a D4P to the L, and we have momenta d pi squared to the L. These are bosonic momenta, and these are the fermionic momenta integrals. Notice that m-bar dependence drops out immediately because you can rescale p with square root of m-bar p and pi by m-bar pi, and the measure is invariant. And you see immediately that this gets rid of the m-bar dependence. Now, if you try to do this, it's easy to see that the pi integration, so you have to absorb the fermion zero modulo, we get zero. And that's basically how you're going to get something non-vanishing to absorb appropriate pi, which brings down with it the glue ball field. So it's easy to see that the integration over the fermionic momenta can only get absorbed by planar diagrams. That's so you can immediately see that only planar diagrams can contribute. For example, if you have a phi cube theory, you will have a diagram like this. If you have a scalar with a phi cube interaction, you will have a diagram like this, but you can have either this kind or that kind of diagram. And the W is emitted from the boundary, the gluino, and there are various ways it could be. You can have here like this or like that. But if you want to have a glue ball field, you want to have a W squared term, and the W squared term here allows you only two W insertions because there's only one boundary here. Here you have two boundaries, so you can have W up to more powers of W. So this can absorb, this can have more W's in it. You can bring more pi's down, and this absorbs the pi momenta, but this doesn't. So just a very simple counting of fermion zero moduli reduces the computation to planar diagrams. Well, so you start computing. Usual way of Feynman, you introduce loop momenta. So the loop momenta, you introduce loop momenta PA. Here we have two loops. And you write the edge momenta in terms of loop momenta with some plus or minus 1 or 0, depending on whether the edge is part of the loop and its orientation. You integrate out the D4P just the same way we do in string theory. We first integrate the momenta out, or the way usually one does in Feynman diagrams anyhow. So you get some S-dependent piece, which is this. This is, again, familiar in the usual Feynman diagram computation. And in string theory, we usually get these factors as a determinant of imaginary part of period matrix and so forth. This is similar to what we're used to in string theory. Now, if you integrate that d2 pi's, in this example, for example, in this particular configuration where these w's come from here, you get two w's coming from the s1 edge and two from the other one, s2 edge. So this s1 edge and s2 edge gives you a factor of s1 squared times s2 squared. Because there's depends on where you insert the gluino field, and there's an S1 length there. So you get a factor of S1 squared times S2 squared in the numerator by the pi integration. But this, the denominator is like this. And you still have to integrate over the S's, the sizes of the moduli of these things. This is as bad or as difficult as any Feynman diagram computation. So where's the simplification? Well, again, if we did not know the fact that string theory tells us this is easy, we would not have pushed it further. But we knew that string theory tells us this should be easy, and string theory just sums up diagrams. So diagram by diagram is not easy, but sums of the diagrams is easy. Namely, this is S1 squared, S2 squared, because two are emitted from this edge, two from this edge. This is S1 squared, S3 squared, because, again, two from S1 edge and two from S3 edge, and so on. And you have these mixed terms. You add them up. They combine. They give you exactly the denominator. The denominator cancels out. You can do the integral. You get immediately the answer. Basically, the S dependence is trivial. You get the 1 over m because you have e to the minus m times the Schwinger times. So you just get 1 over m for each propagator, which is the same as what the matrix model would have used. Namely, the propagator is 1 over m. There are combinatoric factors from the matrix model, the same, because that's the symmetry of the Feynman diagrams. So you have planar diagrams, the same rules as the matrix model, except that we have to choose, as far as the zero modulo, one Etouffe boundary, one Etouffe loop, not to put any S. So we have to choose one of those. So how many ways can that be done? In this example, there are three ways. Either this loop, or that loop should be empty. That's giving an extra factor of 3. And you don't insert any gluiners on that loop, so that gives you a factor of 3 times n. And that 3 times n is crucial because in the matrix model answer, so we would have written here as a contribution of 3 times s squared, the glueball field, times n. And this is just n dfds. When you remember that the genus 0 with 3 holes, you would have put an s cubed there. And this is just dfds term times n. So that's a piece of the glueball computation. Similarly, you can actually compute the coupling constant with the same trick. Now, you want to get one U1 piece left over. So basically, you want to make sure that one of these W's come from 1 and 2 flip, not W squared. So that gives you a trace of W. And that gives you the correction to the U1 coupling constant. And now there's no factor of n because all the toothed indices are gotten rid of. And you get now you have to choose two special holes where you don't, where you put one of each, and that two corresponds, gives rise to the factor of second derivative of d squared fds squared. And that's how you get this second statement. So applications. Well, you can then try to compute non-perturbative results by perturbative computation. There's the Venustiani-Yankelevich part. And then the number, the power of the glueball field is the same as the order of the loop. So a two-loop diagram gives you s squared, three-loop s cubed, etc., with coefficients that we said we can compute using the matrix model very easily. You take the WDS. If you ignore these higher terms, you get the usual vacuum of n equals to 1 with s is e to the minus tau over n. So if you view tau to be large and the weak coupling, s is very small. So you can think about this, these terms as being relatively small in this regime. And so we can do order by order computation by keeping certain number of powers of s. And suppose you have kept up to the s to the k term. Well, if you take this and raise it to the power of k, this looks like the k fractional instanton effect. So the k loop effect in the perturbative diagram gets translated to a k fractional instanton effect, just like one loop was one instanton. So the instanton effect was related to the first loop. Two loop, three loop, and so on successively relate to fractional, higher fractional instanton effect, 2, 3, etc. So loop expansion is a systematic instanton expansion. So this maps, this is the perturbative window, namely the non-perturbative aspects can be studied using perturbative techniques. So F terms for n equals to 1 theories, some of them are known, some of them are not known. We now have a method to compute them. So if you take n equals to 4 and deform by a mass term, this is the n equals to 1 star theory. In these cases, the F term is known, and we could see if we can reproduce those answers using this straightforward perturbative computation. Or we could also see if we can get n equal to 2 star within geometry using these methods. Now, you might think, how would I get to n equal to 2? We are dealing with n equals to 1 theories. But n equals to 2 is, in particular, n equals to 1 theory. If you think about, in particular, the problem with n equal to 2 is that you have some degenerate moduli, the Coulomb branch. So if you lift that branch by giving some potential to the adjoint field, then you can freeze to a particular point on the Coulomb moduli, and then taking the coupling constant of the superpotential to 0, lands you a particular point on the Coulomb branch. And so in this way, you can naturally land on a particular point on the Coulomb branch. And you can see whether or not the n equals to 1 computation we did can reproduce subroutine geometry of that point at the Coulomb branch. And we'll see it does. So the n equals to 1 star, well, what is a superpotential? It's just x commutator y with z. There are three chiral fields, and there's a mass term. So the vacuum is given by the solution of these equations, which give you SE2 representations. If you consider the maximally confining one, the UN is not broken to anything. It's maximally confining. And you get, well, if you compute then the planar diagram from matrix model, you get some expansion for F0. And you can get the W, and then you can get the critical points of the superpotential. And it's instructive to do this loop by loop. So suppose you just stopped at one loop perturbative diagram computation. Well, you just compute, evaluate W at one loop, and you get this where Q is equal to minus tau over n. Suppose you stop at two loop perturbative diagram and compute the superpotential at the critical points. You get an infinite expansion in Q, but you don't trust terms beyond Q squared. You know that higher powers of Q squared will go further corrections because the result have S cubed S to the fourth contributions. So you see up to three loop, n loop, etc. You can trust up to the power of Q to the n here. So if you do all loops, you can trust all the coefficients, and this is the E2 Eisenstein series. And the modularity of the Eisenstein series is what Montana and Aleph suggested. So without assuming modularity, we are deriving it here, but in a non-trivial way, namely, the intermediate steps are not modular. Namely, this is not a modular form. This is not a modular form. This is not. So we are not assuming modularity as an assumption. We're deriving modularity as a byproduct. So this is indeed a powerful technique. We can actually discover facts about this theory which we did not know. Namely, if we did not know there was modularity, we would be struck by the fact that this is a modular object. Well, this can, of course, be done exactly. I'm just showing here loop by loop. This matrix model is among the solvable ones that Kostov et al. Had studied already. So this was already known, the fact that you could solve this matrix model, and so you could have borrowed these results, and you find that there's an elliptic curve in the solution of this matrix model, and that elliptic curve is Aleph-Montana ellipticity, or modularity. And these results were already obtained from field theory by Dori et al. Essentially, these results, I should say, were obtained by Dori et al. And they have also continued this in the context of matrix model and have gotten agreements in the context of various other branches, depending on which other SU, various other representations of SU2 you choose for the branches of n equals to 1 star. You can also get an exact n equals to 2 results. The trick there is the following. Suppose you just want to do pure n equal to 2. So that's n equals to 1 with an adjoint matter. You can break n equal to 2 to n equals to 1 with adding a potential. Here, however, we choose the potential to be of degree n plus 1 so that the number of critical points exactly equal to the rank of the group. So now what we'll do is we distribute the eigenvalues of phi, one for each of these critical points. And in this way, we are basically at the generic point of phi. Namely, you can a1 up to an could be arbitrary. At the end, we'll take lambda back to 0. So we want to go back to n equal to 2. So we use n equals to 1 just as a regularization for the result. So if you solve the matrix model, DWDS, you get a spectral curve. This is the standard technique in matrix models. This is the spectral curve. The spectral curve is also recognized as a Cyrulnik curve. And the periods, tau ij, of this matrix model is exactly given by the corresponding period of the Riemann surface, which is precisely the Cyrulnik description of the coupling constant of this theory at this point on the Coulomb branch. So you recover the results of Cyrulnik and Witten. Now, you might ask, where do we put this non-trivial assumption? Everything seems to be straightforward from perturbation theory. There's one non-trivial assumption which we cannot prove. The non-trivial assumption is that S is a good variable. That I cannot argue. No, that's just the Venetiani-Yankelevich. In other words, you take the Venetiani-Yankelevich piece, which is can just this is the measure of the this is the measure of path integrals, so that's that anomaly. So that's rigorous. The computation of diagrams are also rigorous. No, you can argue. In fact, you can argue that the computation of the diagrams is just like the Weston-Minow theory. It's non-normalized. You can show that perturbative diagrams are exact. What you cannot justify necessarily is that you're supposed to take DWDS. You can compute an effective potential, superpotential, but it's not obvious why S is a good variable. When you say DWDS, you're assuming S is a good variable. That's the only assumption one cannot, that's the only really non-trivial assumption here. The rest of it is really trivial. It is not the same as assuming confinement. There seems to be some confusion on that because some of these theories are actually Higgs completely. In other words, you can go to a branch like the n equal to 2 example I mentioned, un is broken down to u1 to the n. It's not confining. Nevertheless, this works. Namely, it's not the effect that you are assuming confinement. You're just assuming S is a good variable, and that's a non-trivial assumption one cannot a priori justify.
What exactly do you mean by good variables?
Good variables means a good order parameter, namely the field, the effective infrared physics have a complete description in terms of those variables. That's basically what I mean by good variables, that you're not missing any other degrees of freedom or looking at a piece of physics.
You know that the whole chiral ring is made out of this, right? I mean,
so it's a good argument. From based on chiral ring, for example, you can argue that chiral ring is based, there's no other thing that you're missing as far as chiral ring. So it's natural, therefore, that superpotential, so that's an added argument why you should treat it. But it's still not clear why you should treat that S as a fundamental variable. That's not, that's still a bit strange. Namely, suppose, for example, we just had the tree level, tau S. And suppose you do not have any further correction, like there was no other term. And then I said treat S as a fundamental variable. That sounds very strange. We usually don't do that. So that's, you know, it's suggesting that, for example, the F wedge F in the action is the auxiliary field of S. That is strange. So that's the non-trivial assumption one is making. That's, I think, the main guts of the assumption, the fact that S is a good order parameter, good field, good way to describe the infrared physics. But the rest is trivial. Now, this, as I mentioned before, this came from a string theory construction at first, but this is not a Riemann surface, this is not a Calabi threefold, this is a Riemann surface. The way this appears in the context of string theory is in the context of a Calabi threefold, where the right-hand side of this equation is not zero, but actually two other variables, u times v. So you look at the hypersurface in C4, which is a non-compact Calabi threefold. The basic part of the geometry is a Riemann surface. And this, in the context of Calabi, comes from the fact that you can put n units of fluxes depending on where you're putting these cuts in the matrix model, and how many fluxes is going corresponds to Ni times DFTSI. And that's exactly the same way we would have done in string theory when you have a flux in there caused by the Ramon Ramon background in the closed string side. So this is the closed string part of it. So the matrix model geometry should be viewed as a closed string dual. So in this context, for example, Wigner's observation that the Gaussian matrix model is related to semicircles should be viewed as the first example of ADS-CFD, if you wish, or more precisely, gauge theory gravity duality. Namely, an n by n matrix can be replaced by geometry. In that case, a semicircle. He was describing the closed string geometry with a circle, which is a special case of this when w prime of x is just x. So he had y squared plus x squared as a constant. And that was his semicircle. But it's natural to ask, in the context of matrix model, how do you get the full Calabi geometry? The matrix model seems to only have the resolvent, not the Calabi geometry. Well, the answer, again, we know from string theory, due to the work of Klebanoff and Witten, and also Klebanoff and Strassler, which is to introduce the three brains. So if you take the three brains, we know that you can move the D3 brains off to any point in Calabi, so then you can have a more degrees of freedom in that context. So in that context, the gauge theory system gets bigger. Namely, you have a UN1 times UN2 system with some bifundamental matter field, with two adjoint fields, with some potential, with an interaction of this form between the bifundamental matter fields and the adjoint fields, and some superpotential of these two adjoint fields, phi1 and phi2. The case that Klebanoff and Strassler studied was with a case where W of phi is phi squared. This could be extended to other cases for general W and related to the string geometry as we did with Cacciozzo and Katz. So chiral fields of this theory are in one-to-one correspondence to the full deformation of the Calabi. So in this context, if you study this matrix model with this potential, so in other words, if you take this matrix model and study it, you would be getting not just a resolvent, you have more degrees of freedom, and those will actually end up giving you Calabi, the full Calabi. So as is known, the chiral fields in that case is larger, and you have these elements in the chiral ring composed of various combination of A's, AI1, AJ1, AI2, AJ2, et cetera, which when you write it in terms of the, if you deform the action with those, they are exactly the same elements as the elements of the C equals to 1 at CF2 radius. It's the same as the observables of C equals to 1, and they deform this the conifold by such terms. So if you added these terms to the action, you'll get a deformed conifold. So the correlators of all the Kaluza-Klein modes in the context of conifold coming from the Kaluza-Klein things are captured precisely by this matrix model. So if you're interested in F-terms, holomorphic quantities involving these closed Klein modes, you might as well study the F-terms in this matrix model. It has the full information there. The matrix model involving phi1, phi2, and a1 and ai. But there's actually even yet a better way of saying it in this case. This is the same as a matrix model of a unitary supergroup. Namely, if you take un1 slash n2 with a supertrace w phi squared potential and go to the gauge where the upper block is phi1 and the lower block is phi2, then the ghosts, which usually we put here in this gauge, fermions, in this case is actually are bosonic because it's a superdirection. So in other words, you're applying the ghost of a superdirection becomes bosonic, and these are the bifundamental matter fields. So if you were to study this supergroup, you would get the same system as Klebanov and Strasser studied, but actually in that setup you can easily see the cascade story much more easily in this context. Namely, this is now then coming from the superstructure of this theory. So you get cancellation between eigenvalues, so this effectively behaves as if there's just un1 minus n2, the theory. So that fact can easily be seen from the supergroup description. It's the fact that the super, if you compute the Tuff diagrams, the supertrace of n1 minus n1 n2 is n1 minus n2. So that's only the difference comes in. You don't care about individual factors. That's the cascade structure. So the observables of this theory give you the full Calabi-Yau geometry. So if you take the supergroup, the superhermitian matrix model with the Gaussian term, almost what Wigner studied, he would have hit upon Calabi-Yau threefold, the conifold and its deformations. He would have been forced to study that if he had studied just superversion of what he did. And it's the most general observables in that story. So he was that close to conifolds. Now, question. Well, I don't know whether he would or not, but it's a supergroup, but does not depend on N1 and N2. It depends only on the difference. If you add observables in the superdirection to break that, then you would do something to that. That's true. But anyhow, this is all this thing. Just to make it more interesting. Now, the question is, these are F-terms. These are only holomorphic stuff. What about the rest of the string theory? Well, we're not that far. Why is that? If you take a conformal theory in two dimensions with n equal to 2, you know that F-terms completely fix the D-terms. That is, the marginalized space of the superconformal field theories are completely characterized by F-terms. Said differently, if you have a superconformal field theory, the only deformations allowed are by F-terms. So their marginali are captured by F-terms. So if you know all the F-terms data, you in principle know which conformal theory you're talking about. That was in fact a powerful technique in two dimensions, where just by studying Landau-Ginzburg theory, which is basically studying chiral theory, you were capturing data about the full conformal theory. In four dimensions, we don't have a proof, but it's the belief that this is still true. Namely, there's no counterexample known to the fact that the moduli of superconformal n equals to 1 theories in four dimensions are only given by F-terms as well. It would have been bizarre if there is a D-term that is also an exactly marginal deformation of n equals to 1. This would suggest, for example, having a real moduli of superconformal field theories in four dimensions with n equals to 1. Be very bizarre. We always believe that's a holomorphic thing, complex thing, coming from F-term deformations. If that is the case, which we don't have a proof of in four dimensions, this would suggest, again, the F-terms characterize the full theory. So implicitly, computation of this F-term has the full information about the string theory. So in principle, this could have the full information. Of course, extracting it is a non-trivial statement. But it would be nevertheless interesting to see, at least even in principle, this could be completely fixing the data of a string theory. So as I already mentioned, that if you take W phi is phi squared, you get the conifold, and that's related to C equals to 1 itself to a radius in the topological string language. That's something that Goshal and I showed a while back. And so the planar diagrams of this, the genus 0 diagrams, correspond to F terms of conifold and flux of type 2B. What time do I have? 50 more minutes. This can be generalized to C equal to 1 at k times itself to the radius. So if you take this theory and model it by ZK. You know that C equals to 1 if you want to go to K times the set of rays, you model it by ZK. So you take a quotient of this by ZK, you get instead of this Coover theory with 2K nodes. Again, with this bifundamental matter with the phi school potential. So this is K times itself to a radius. So if you take this matrix model and study the amplitudes of this theory, you can in principle study not only the momentum modes of C equals 1, but also the winding modes, that the data is equivalent to studying this matrix model. Well, K goes to infinity limit is also interesting. The radius infinity is basically infinite line. It seems, though, what we're doing is that the theory space idea is coming back to us. Namely, this is, I'm saying, the real line, and the two-node case was the minimum radius, C equals to 1 itself the radius. So K is roughly the amount of radius, and this seems to be itself the C equals to 1 line, the C equals to 1 line. And indeed, it seems that the tachyon excitations in the C equals to 1 get mapped to changing the rank of these groups away from being equal. So if you perturb the values of the ranks from ni to ni plus delta I and study the F terms for that theory, you're studying the C equals to 1 amplitudes involving tachyons, depending on which tachyon modes you study. So here, I haven't told you what's the rank of these groups. Okay, I'm just saying that you start with all n equal. That's the conformal one. So if you take all n's equal and the bifundamentals, that's just the conformal theory. Then you can add mass terms, phi squared, and you can also change the ranks of the groups. This is what, for example, was crucial in the context of Klebanov and Strasser. They had, if the ranks of the two nodes were equal, you would be at the conformal point. Even if you had phi squared, as soon as you change the rank, you're going to the massive theory. Changing the rank is dramatic there, and it gets mapped to this tachyon amplitudes of C equals to 1. So studying, said differently, if you're interested in studying F terms for this system, when you deform these ranks of each node in a particular way, you are effectively studying the amplitudes of C equals to 1, the tachyon amplitudes.
So you're saying the tachyon field?
Yes. Yes, yes, in a limit, of course. We have to take some particular rescaling limit. This is the local deformations of this. The profile of this ranks is a tachyon wave.
Is this a conjecture?
No, we have discussed this because we have already discussed in the paper with Robert as a consequence of the C equals to 1 being related to Conifold now quotienting by ZK. So this follows from that. And then it also relates to another thing, which is what Arkani, Hamid et al. Were doing in the context of deconstruction and getting 2,0 theories. They were exactly studying this kind of system to get a good description of 2,0 system in 6 dimensions. And so in this context, what we are saying is that C equals to 1 amplitudes, tachyon amplitudes, are giving you F terms data for deformations of the 2,0 theory. They did not change the rank. So what they did was they have equal n's.
Right.
So they had equal n's, and that was the n theory, which was 2,0 with n.
Right.
So this is a deformation of their theory. So so roughly speaking, it's like a probe. See, if they had 5 brains which reconnected, deformed brains which reconnected when you take the NS5 brains out. If you have extra things, they would not be able to reconnect. So you can take the minimal out, but there would be extra D brains stuck. So you can think of these as probes, extra things left over to their background. So this is deformations or probes in the context that they studied. It would be actually very interesting to try to clarify the precise map between the tachyon amplitudes and this precisely what deformations they are. There's actually another, this is the other direction I wanted to mention. The relation between 4 plus k-dimensional supersymmetric system and k-dimensional bosonic gauge theories. So the question was the first question we raised for ourselves was, if matrix models give you F terms for n equals to 1 in 4 dimension, what is quantum mechanics of matrix models good for? So it's natural to expect that this must have some role for something, if this is true, and similarly for high-dimensional bosonic gauge systems. The idea is actually quite simple. You can view the higher dimensional gate system from the D equals to 4 perspective. You just have infinitely many matrices. And this is the usual discretization of the space, and viewing it as some superpotentials in four-dimensional terms. A simple example is actually something that Warren Siegel did like 20 years ago or so, was to view the n equals to 1 in 10 dimensions from the perspective of n equals to 1 fields in 4 dimensions, and his observations that you'll introduce in terms of, so you can think about the corresponding superpotential as an extra term like this. You have these fields phi I, which are these three complex fields that you have in n equals to 1, d equals to 4. But you have, in addition of depending on x's, they also depend on the y, the extra six dimensions. And in order to get the 10-dimensional answer back, you had to introduce, in terms of this y integral, which you can think of as just a dummy variable from the four-dimensional perspective, index variable, you had to introduce the Chern-Simon action. Why did he have to do that? The reason he did it was almost obvious. Why is that? Well, think about this abstractly as superpotential of W. What do you do with W? You take the derivative of W with respect to the fields and square it and add it to the action when you integrate these things out, when you integrate the d2 thetas out. So let's see why this does that. Well, since the potential is the variation of superpotential pi squared, variation of Chern-Simon with respect to this field is the field strength, Fij. You square it and you add it to the action. Well, that's what you want. You want to have Fij, the field strengths, in the corresponding sixth direction that you were missing. This reconstructs it. So if you ask, what is Chern-Simon in six dimensions good for? The answer is, it's good for the study of D9 brains. So that actually explains why the topological B model gives you Chern-Simon. You could have actually directly gone to that from this Siegel's observation. The fact that the superpotential is equal to the corresponding topological data explains why if you had D9 brains on the collaborative threefolds, you would have gotten the holomorphic Chern-Simon. It had to be the holomorphic Chern-Simon. In this case, the holomorphic one, which is the one I just wrote down over here. So this actually explains what that means, why that map was between the four-dimensional, in this case, would be the 10-dimensional gauge theory. The 10-dimensional gauge theory has an extra six-dimensional gauge theory in it, which is the internal Chern-Simon if you're just interested in the F-terms. So if you just want to study the F-terms on a D9 brain, you would just study the holomorphic Chern-Simon on the intermediate Calabi-Yau threefold. And this, as I said, was already known from topological string perspective because that's where we landed on the story. Namely, we started from the Chern-Simon and the topological B model, but now we can actually recover back without assuming string theory, just directly from the fact that you're trying to write down something on the word volume which looks like F squared. And this is the only way. You want to have a field strength. The variation of the field being field strength defines Chern-Simon, actually. Another example is suppose you're interested in studying five-dimensional supersymmetric gauge theories. This gets mapped to matrix quantum mechanics. In fact, the number of variables, as is clear from my description, relates, the number of extra dimensions relates to the on each side's match, so you have 4 plus 1 here, and a one-dimensional matrix model, which is matrix quantum mechanics. You might first want to do pure quantum, pure matrix models, namely no matter field. What do you do there? Well, you have a circle, and no matter field means holonomy. That's all you have. Well, that's known otherwise as unitary matrix model. So it's basically promoting that Hermitian field into a unitary field, U. And beta, you can rewrite it like this in terms of the radius of that circle. We can deform this theory by adding potential for W of U so that you can break this n equal to 2 system to n equals to 1 system by adding potentials now in terms of this unitary matrix. And one can study it. So in fact, this gives you cyber-Witten curves for the four-dimensional theory as a function of the radius going from 5 to 4. And this works. So the radius of the unitary matrix gets mapped to that radius dependence there. Or we can consider matrix quantum mechanics with the usual one, where you have, I write the matrix quantum mechanics in this form, PI, DQI, T, with some Hamiltonian of P and Q, plus a superpotential I add for the holonomy, W of U. And in fact, this combination reconstructs back the hypermultiplet, PI, QI, coupled on n equals to 1 in 5 dimensions. And this is a deformation. These terms are actually deformation to n equals to 4 supercharges rather than 8. So without these, this would be a 4 supercharge theory, 8 supercharge theory. With these, it will deform it down to 4. And in fact, examples of this kind have been studied by Hollywood in a beautiful paper he recently wrote. And he recovered, actually, conjectures that Nekrasov had made for n equals to 1 star in going from 5 to 4, basically by introducing matter fields for the n equals to 1 star in 5 dimensions and studying the matrix quantum mechanics, and recovered some very nice answers. Hollywood did that recently, like a month or two ago. And he recovered the conjecture that Nikita Nekrasov had made about this 6-7 years ago, actually. I'll just say one transparency and generalization to other groups. So here I have talked about UN, and everything seemed to be geared up to large N and all that. The computation on superpotential to other groups and representation, perturbatively straightforward, actually. It turns out you always get the cancellation of the numerator and denominator I showed you. It has nothing to do with the UN. The way I presented it sounded like it was a fact about the UN, but actually you can do it for any group and any representation. And the answer, I'll just show you, it's a beautiful answer, I think, and it would be interesting to explore it further. It's the following. So suppose you take any group, for example, E8, let's say, or something, with some matter field. So you can write the corresponding matrix model with interactions and so on, which correspond to the superpotential of the corresponding group. Well, if you write the diagrams of the corresponding matrix model, you get some diagrams. I'm not drawing it in the language of Etouffe because it doesn't exist. It's just E8, for example. But nevertheless, we have the usual Feynman diagrams. And on each edge of the Feynman diagram, there's a particular charged object going on that edge, which you can characterize as a vector on the weight lattice of the group. Now, there's a conservation law of the group, which means that the sum of the weight vectors and each node is zero, which means that you can associate to each loop a weight. So if you take, if you have a number of loops, you can form an L by L matrix composed of the dot products of the weights in each loop, lambda 1 up to lambda of the number of loops. There's an L by L matrix, you take its determinant, and multiply it by F of lambda. And this turns out to be the correction to the S to the L, the Lth power of the group of potential. Now, why is that related to planar diagrams in the UN case? Well, the reason is that if it weren't planar in the UN case, the determinant would be zero. Because you would have some edges, the fact that you have less Letouffed indices means there's a linear relation for these weights, and that means the determinant is zero. So this, in that case, is projection to planar diagrams. But this makes sense for any group. It has nothing to do with UN. So this, if you wish, you can view this as the projection to planar part. Except there is a non-trivial issue here, which is the following. This computation, planar diagrams, makes sense up to the rank of the group. Beyond that rank, this determinant vanishes. Doesn't make sense, because there's no more than the rank of the group that you can make linearly independent. On the other hand, this factorial becomes negative and infinity. So the computation becomes ambiguous. You get 0 times infinity beyond the loop, the rank of the group. So the computation of the superpotential becomes ambiguous beyond the rank of the group. OK, so what does that mean? Well, should we have expected such ambiguities? And the answer is actually yes. The reason is this. If you take S to the power of the rank of the group, if you take it sufficiently high power, classically it's zero. So if you add it to the action and ask, what is my theory? You could say, it's there, it's not there, it's there, it's not there. It's zero. Classically, it doesn't matter. But the quantum theory is different. So it matters whether or not you put it there or not put it there, but you cannot unambiguously treat it in a quantum theory, in a classical theory. So you're going to be hit by an ambiguous term involving powers of S to the L. OK, how do you resolve the ambiguities? So the question is, it occurs for finite U2 even, U3. Beyond third order, it would be ambiguous. So how do you actually then define all this? We are having this infinite loop order and so on, how do you get these higher loop objects? So the way we did it is the following. So there's, of course, a prescription I mentioned to you in terms of this computation of ETUF diagrams that I showed to you. What does that mean? So what I was doing there was basically putting two W's at each ETUF index. That's a perfectly well-defined computation. And in that context, gives you a well-defined coefficient here, which is what I was doing. So that computation there was basically treating two W's per index loop. That computation effectively is the same as the following. In that case, in the case of classical groups A, B, C, D, it's like doing it for a large enough N, which is not ambiguous, and analytically continuing it and not worrying about any point. That would be the same as that rule. Then that was that computation. But the question is, can that be justified? Well, it depends on what do we mean by justified. In some cases, it cannot be justified. For example, take UN gauge group, pure Yang Mills. U1 does not have a global superpotential, but UN does. So if you say the expectation of the global field S is e to the minus tau over N, and analytically continuing equals to 1, you're going to get the wrong answer. So how could you argue that's the same? Well, so that sounds like a paradox. How would we say in what cases it does and in what cases it doesn't? So what we did, actually, we embedded this system in a bigger system for which we could argue there is no further correction. So in other words, and this relates to cascade, actually, and the supergroup, so I should probably say a little bit. How much time do we have? Can I continue? So let me start with this case with the example I just said, W of phi. So this is the original example I studied. So in that context, you could have said that beyond N loop, you're going to be hit in trouble. But actually, you can do the following. You can take this theory and take UN plus K slash K with a superpotential W of phi. If you take K large enough, yes, but this is the supergroup realization. But of course, it's an ordinary Coover theory. This is exactly the Klebanov-Strasser system, would be formed by the superpotential W of phi. If you take K large enough, the ambiguity goes like S to the N plus 2K. So if you take K to infinity, there's no ambiguity. No, I'm not finished. I will come to it. So K goes to infinity, so you could say, what does the prescription mean? The prescription means the computation for this system for K goes to infinity. That's what that means. So that's the precise gauge theory for which that's the computation done. Okay, then you ask, what is the relation of that with this one that I'm interested in? Well, then you come to the following point, that if you Higgs the system down step by step and take the wave large enough, you don't lose the instant information and you can go down all the way, except when the pi 3 of G mod H is non-zero. So when you go back from the group G to the H, you might get what is called residual instanton effects. So if you do get them, then you might get additional instant corrections at the time you go down. And if you don't get them, you're fine. So in these examples, you can actually show you don't get residual instanton effects. So if you study with large K, which is then unambiguous, and then take K goes to zero, you're in a safe territory. But there are some other examples that Krauss et al. Have studied in which that's not the case. You do get residual instanton effects. And in fact, we computed them in a recent paper with Warner and Interligator and Aganagic. Am I missing somebody? I think that's correct. And we actually reproduced their changed answer relative to the matrix model. So in fact, you can actually capture maybe the answer from the would-be, not this is not the system they studied, but some other gate system, SPN, with some matter. And we had an answer which agreed with the matrix model up to the Lth loop, the rank of the group, and there was some difference beyond that. And in that case, we first of all said, what is their answer good for? What's the matrix model answer mean? Namely, the SPN times SON system. There's also a cascade story there. And then the question was whether there's a residual instanton effect at the last step or not. And we showed in that case there was. So there was a big difference there. So in fact, this is already familiar, even if I did one case here. If you take the case U1 case, in the Klebanov-Strasser story, even the U1 case has a global VIF. In other words, there is already a residual instanton effect when you go down from U2 times U1 down to U1. In other words, this is not the ordinary U1. This is the U1 which has instanton. And that you can see that this residual instanton is what would be the difference between that smooth answer in string theory versus the non-smooth answer, which is U1 has not the anticontinuation of U1 with n equals to 1. So you can understand that difference in that context. But you can show that it doesn't hit you when n is bigger than 1 in these cases. And it's a rare phenomenon where it does happen, but anyway, one can study those. I think I should stop here. Thanks.